Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, April 1st. I'm Ray Graff. Today, we welcome back Dr. Eric Yeager, a virologist and educator at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. He teaches virology, biology, microbiology, genetics. We'll find out what's new, what new viruses we should be scared to death about. It's always fun to have him on the show, and Eric will take your calls. Call early, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or you can email, if you wish, voxpop@wamc.org is the email, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Eric Yeager, virology, and don't be scared, give us a call right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Dr. Eric Yeager joins us today. Dr. Eric Yeager is Department Chair of Allied Health Sciences at Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Eric has a PhD in biomedical sciences from the University at Albany. He teaches virology, biology, microbiology, and genetics. At least that's what it was on the last script. Who knows what it is now? He's here to take your calls. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll get to the email bag as we roll along, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Eric Yeager, how you doing, buddy?
Doing well, Ray. Good afternoon. Glad to be back. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. And what's new over at Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences?
Oh, the students are studying hard. We're about on the downside of the spring semester, heading towards graduation. So,
now, when you say the downside, does that mean all the faculty just sort of kicks back into glide?
I wouldn't say that. I think it's there's a certain level of fatigue I think we all get as you kind of the peak of the semester. We kind of get towards that end. But the students are great. The faculty get to work with are still going strong, and looking forward to seeing the students walk across the stage in May.
Now, you know, I haven't looked at my calendar, but we are now getting close to the end of the cold and flu, or is it over now this season?
I think it's safe to say we're on the down slope there. Cases are dropping, so I think it's safe to say that the cold and flu season that, you know, I'm kind of the, I started it off in October, and here I am at the end of it, so it worked out well.
You know,
I don't know if I'm like a groundhog of viruses of sorts, but.
Well, I've always considered you to be that. The number here is 800-348-2551. The work you put in during the pandemic still is in the Hall of Fame here at WAMC. Now, you had said something to me that I had heard before while we were chatting before the show. And you said, the vaccine for the flu this year, sort of a half a hit, half a miss. What went wrong, and how do they make that call, and why did it not be as effective as they wanted?
Yeah, happy to review that. So the process of making the flu is it takes a lot of work by epidemiologists and other scientists to, based on the Southern Hemisphere, so flu season switches between us and Southern Hemisphere. So looking at what flu strains are circulating in the Southern Hemisphere during their winter, which is our summer, kind of gives us some information about what strains likely are going to come up to us.
Right.
So that process, the process for making the flu vaccine that we'll get in the fall actually started last year. So it's based on predictions, based on what viruses they isolate from patients, typically in the Southern Hemisphere. And then they take those, they adapt them to be used for the vaccine. The vaccine is typically grown in eggs and some other mechanisms we can talk about, but that process takes a while. And a couple of things can happen is, best evidence-based decision to pick the right strains at the time. The strains could change. Sometimes when they're grown in the eggs to produce the vaccine, they can mutate slightly. So they might not exactly match the strain. So in some cases, you know, we're very good in matching in the vaccine. Going back a little bit, so the term like effectiveness versus efficacy. So it's, you know, how many cases did it prevent of infection or severity? And as you probably saw in the news, as you mentioned, like the efficacy, I think, is in the 34, 35%, which sounds like, You know, someone said, I'm going to give you, in my class, right? If I'm going to tell a student, hey, you got a 98, you're like, fantastic. Hey, you got a 34, they're not going to be happy, right?
No. now you're bringing back some memories. Right. Let me tell you something.
The important thing about the vaccines is even when the efficacy begins to drop like that, again, it's another reason why we looked at other modalities for vaccines like mRNA vaccines and things like that. But importantly for this vaccine, even though the level of protection was not as high as we'd hoped, the vaccine has, again, because even at that 30%, you're preventing thousands of hospitalizations, thousands of ER visits, thousands of deaths.
If you prevent it, though, how do you know?
They collect the data looking at in the course of the year, how many cases of, you know, hospitalizations were flu related, how many ER visits and in different age groups. And groups like the CDC and other groups globally are tracking this information because it gives us an idea of the patient comes in, were you vaccinated, yes or no? So they can tell how effective it was. But we do know from past history, and this is not the first time the vaccine match wasn't the greatest. So that level of protection was around that 30-40%. Again, the secondary benefits of vaccination, particularly if you're someone that is in a high risk group, like if you're older, if you have cardiovascular disease, lung disease, the vaccine, there's a wealth of data out there to support that getting the vaccine, even if it didn't match well, still protects against these complications that can happen if you get the flu.
So the Southern Hemisphere is where we sort of get the information we need to make this vaccine.
That's right. Land down under with
why are they
men
first?
At work.
Why are they first, man? Why wouldn't they say, well, up in the Northern Hemisphere, they had this. Well, we'll do this.
I think it's just partly with the weather changes. So again, seasonal changes, similar to like with us, right? When it's colder, when it's that colder season, people are indoors more, humidity drops a bit, the viruses can circulate a bit easier. So I think it's just at some point, you know, when they started making the vaccine, they just realized that there was a switch. So the predictions are based on the Southern Hemisphere predominantly.
Interesting. And Eric Yeager is our guest today. It's virology, and we'll get to the calls in a bit. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. I want to explore just a little bit this whole seasonal connection. The viruses themselves are not affected by the changing seasons, right? It's just how the humans congregate and what they do, or am I wrong?
No, the viruses themselves, it's more changes in human behavior than the viruses themselves. Certainly viruses are susceptible to temperature changes, and part why we can, you know, disinfect and sterilize equipment for hospitals and dental offices. But by and large, it's more human behavior that just renders the viruses more easily to transmit from person to person in a community setting.
And we knew from the horrendous thing, the pandemic, that some viruses are way more communicable than others. And as the flu went this year, where did it stand?
It wasn't as severe as last year was kind of taking a look back, and it takes some time for all that epidemiological data to be collected to understand fully how many hospitalizations and deaths were linked to flu. So we know from based on that data that the 24-25 season was considered severe. It caused an increased number of hospitalizations and deaths that were modeled. So there's individuals, you know, smarter than me that can do mathematical modeling. They try to model how severe the upcoming flu and cold season is going to be. So last season was a high severe season. This one, not as severe, but the concern you probably saw in the news was the H3N2 subclade K that was circulating.
I didn't that see tends- that. Not by that
you
name.
Missed it?
I don't know. What is that?
On the virology aspect of things, when the viruses begin to change, we can detect those changes with different tests, mostly genetic tests, mm-hmm. and we can determine what strain is circulating predominantly. So that's a strain that took, you know, scientists by surprise and wasn't, you know, totally part of that vaccine. So that's why, again, the flu vaccine this year wasn't as protective. So it was kind of a strain that was coming up. So in terms of severity, that strain, again, the names get kind of scary. Right now, there's a BA.3.2 COVID. They might give it certain names in the media to make it seem like, here. A lot of clickbait. But by and large, I mean, these changes happen year to year. Again, scientists are looking to make sure, have they gained more transmissibility? Are they resistant to our vaccine or our drugs? So that's what they're really tracking. These changes are, you know, something we expect to happen. So back to your initial question. Sorry, I went into academic mode.
I forgot what it was, but
forgot.
Go ahead.
I'm good that way too. Yeah. kind of throw some smoke here. Yeah. But this season was, certainly there were hospitalizations and deaths due to flu, RSV, and COVID. But at least for flu, it was not as severe as last year. even with the vaccine not matching.
Measles was a thing.
Measles is still a thing, unfortunately. So last data I checked last night, I think we're over 1,500 cases. So we're likely going to eclipse the 2,000
in the country, last year. In the nation.
Yeah, in the nation.
Doesn't seem like a lot.
It doesn't. I think, but that, you know, where we were, you know, 5, 10 years ago, we're talking like, you know, under 100,
yeah,
under 50. So, so sadly, we're at a much higher rate than we expect to. And the more cases, you know, unfortunately, it's not like the Brady Bunch where like, hey, it's the measles, don't worry about it. It's it is a disease that can impact children severely. It can lead to death. So any increase in cases is alarming.
We're joined by Eric Yeager from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Virology Today, 800-348-2551 if you have a question. And we'll take a break in a moment, and then we'll get to those calls. 800-348-2551. You can email voxpop@wamc.org. I know I've asked you this before. You have been on perhaps more than any guest in the last 5 years just because of all the horrible things that happened in the world. I've asked you this before.
Yeah.
You have 1 minute.
All right.
Is a virus alive?
My answer is no, because they need the help of a host cell to complete their life cycle. So viruses are not alive in a sense, in a biological sense.
And how do they reproduce then? And where's the intelligence coming that says, oh, well, I need a host and I want to propagate, and how am I going to do that?
They just evolved to, you know, almost like a computer program, I guess you could say. They get inside the cell. They have all the blueprint that they need to take over that cell to produce more copies of themselves. So
how did the first virus come about then?
That's a great question. There's a lot of different theories. You know, did it arrive on an asteroid? Was there something like in a hot spring? So a lot of the same kind of idea of trying to understand where bacteria arose from. So there's, I don't think there's one kind of single theory to say this is how it happened. But at some point, you know, DNA viruses, RNA viruses, you know, they chose a way to infect a cell to replicate that. You know, from our, as we started them, it might seem bizarre. It might not seem the best choice to have. Why would you want to live this way? But they selected that. It seemed to work, and they've existed for, you know, as long as we have.
Eric Yeager is our guest. We'll take a break here, and then we'll hit the phones. 800-348-2551. Oh, how appropriate. All right. Well, let's just play some music. We'll be back. And behind curtain number one, it's the flu. You're going to die. 800-348-2551. It's Dr. Eric Yeager from the Department of Allied Health Sciences at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. David in Saratoga Springs, go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Yeager and Ray. David from Saratoga.
You got it.
I was reading an article in the Scientific American back September 5th, and they're talking about the gut virome and how it supports wellness. And we know if our gut biome gets out of balance, what happens? But I'm wondering your insights on the newly discovered virome that comprises 1% of our gut biome.
Virome. Oh, no. Not another thing to worry about. No, I've not heard of this. All right. Go ahead.
Great question. Thank you, David. So the many of us may have heard of, you know, kind of gut health and the microbiome. It's been a very hot topic, I'd say, the past maybe 5, 10 years. A lot of focus on, you know, there are more microbes in our bodies than cells. So you can make the argument of like who owns, you know, the body. So what we know is that the bacteria and viruses that live inside our body do have importance in a lot of the biological functions. They're important in host defense, certainly, but in other types of health as well. I think, in my estimation, there's a lot more known about maybe the bacteria portion of the microbiome, because you can isolate them, do a little bit more studying. The viruses have been a little bit more challenging, but certainly we know they're there. And I think this is kind of the one of beneficial stories, right? We always focus on like the dark side of viruses causing disease. But here, these are viruses that, again, we've contracted at some point, or usually early in life, and they're important to have in our bodies. And you might hear the term dysbiosis. So if there's this disruption in that microbiome, that can lead to disease. So there's a lot of research focusing in on now what viruses are part of our virome, bacteria as well. How do they work together? In some cases, there's some collaboration, and really how they are important for our normal biological processes, but importantly, too, links to disease. So if we can understand where these disturbances come in, can we correct those disturbances? So there's a lot of fascinating work done on, and I think a lot of companies now are focusing on the microbiome because there is a lot of link to diseases like cancer, diseases, even how vaccines work. In some cases, is a vaccine to work better if you have a certain microbiome balance?
David.
Well, I appreciate the response, and I look forward to learning more about how it we can maintain our wellness through our virome as well as our biome.
Well, thanks a lot for the call, David. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You know, something you said right before the break has stuck with me now. I asked you where the first virus came from, and you said, well, you know, we don't know. Maybe it was on an asteroid. What conditions are necessary to kill a virus? If something could live in deep space, can you kill them at all?
They, as scary as they are, viruses are quite fragile. They're made up of very simply nucleic acids, either DNA and RNA. That's the blueprints for what the virus needs to replicate. A protein that wraps around that, a capsid. I like to use the analogy of a candy shell. And then some envelope, and some viruses have an envelope made of lipids that come from the host cell. So for most viruses, they need to get to that host cell immediately because, again, they can't replicate on their own. Temperature changes, pH changes. You know, there are certain viruses that are able to persist a little longer. Like an example would be a polio or norovirus. I'll focus on norovirus because we kind of are more familiar with that one. So the cruise ship virus, that you get sick for a few days. That's a virus that is a little bit more fastidious. It doesn't mean that it's invincible, but it takes a little bit more effort to get rid of. But for the most part, viruses are very fragile. Any damage to the envelope, virus can't infect. Any damage to nucleic acids, the virus can't replicate. So before they get inside that cell, again, they're fragile. So there's where we come into play is understanding, again, disinfecting surfaces, certainly. But then once they get inside our bodies, like what medications could we develop or have access to try to treat these infections.
Eric Yeager is our guest today from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. The number is 800-348-2551 if you want to jump in. Fred's in Eastern Massachusetts. Fred, go ahead.
Yes. The first 21 years of my life, I got two colds and the flu once every year. And then on a beautiful day like today, I was walking down the street. An old man met me, and I explained how sick I was that year. And he said, gargle with warm salt water and let some trickle down your throat. He said, these viruses are basically around all year, and it's because you're dried out from internal heat. I have not had a cold or the flu in the last 50 years.
Wow. Okay. That's pretty good.
Life is good.
Yeah, man. What do you think, Eric?
Yeah, I'm glad to hear, Fred, your story of, you know, being infection-free. Hopefully that continues for you.
Yeah,
through
knock
spring.
Wood.
Yeah, knock on wood. A couple aspects. I think the drying out aspect. So our body's immune system, it's called the innate immune system. We're born with it. One of the features of our innate immune system is mucus. And mucus is incredibly important because it traps microbes like viruses, and it helps prevent, it works to prevent them from getting access to our cells and causing disease. So we have kind of that natural barrier to begin with. I would say gargling salt water by itself, you know, it might have some role in perhaps like, you know, dislodging bacteria or viruses. I think directly, it's difficult to say like that's going to be a cure-all for a viral infection, but certainly there are some remedies like that. Like, you know, again, part of our innate defense is like the mucus, coughing, sneezing, that evolved to get the virus out of us. Certainly with the flu and cold season, one of the things that happens is when it gets colder, the humidity drops, and what can typically happen is the amount of water in the mucus begins to decrease. So that, again, thins the mucus layer.
Yeah.
And then that does make it a little, I think, more accessible for bacteria and viruses to cause disease.
So you stay hydrated then?
Stay hydrated, yeah. Staying hydrated is very important. Good nutrition as well. So I'm hesitant to fully, you know, recommend gargling. but if it, you know, if it's working for Fred, I think keep with it.
You know, here's the thing.
Yeah.
There are over hundreds, thousands of years, there have been folk remedies.
Yeah.
Before there were doctors, there were folk remedies. Is, you know, can there be a kernel of truth to some of these things?
Yeah, I think as a scientist, you know, it's always, you know, show me the evidence. We're taught to be kind of skeptics, but yeah. If the evidence is there and we do some studies, you know, anything could possibly work. So the gargling, right, if we had this, and maybe there's been one, I'm not sure, but like a controlled clinical trial, gargling, no gargling, did it impact, you know, infection, things like that. So, you know, I'm open to any kind of thing as long as there's some, you know, evidence-based findings there to support that remedy.
Eric Yeager is our guest today from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences Virology, 800-348-2551. We'll get back to the phones in just a moment. This is something in the years post-pandemic I've asked, and it's another year has passed. So what lessons have we taken out of this? What has science learned that will make it easier to navigate the next one, which is probably inevitable?
I'd say lessons is, you know, more of an understanding that, you know, these viruses, they evolve. They can still pose dramatic public health threats. I think more of the lessons are probably on, I'd say, the government side to really do the best to protect communities. So surveillance is very important. Continuing funding research into viruses is important so we can identify good therapies and vaccines. But I think the lesson, too, and I've always stressed, is it was amazing for me to see, you know, just the amount of people coming together from a variety of different scientific and other types of specialty backgrounds, communities coming together. Like, you know, that was as rough as kind of life is now. I think back then, you know, we saw like the best of humanity, right, coming together to try to solve this critical threat.
I mean, at least we can get toilet paper now.
Yeah, at least we can get toilet paper.
Pretty good. But the mRNA vaccines, yeah. Right? And so this was a kind of a big deal, yeah. Much ballyhooed. What have we learned about their efficacy?
I think it's given us, and the research on those vaccines had been, you know, going on for years before COVID, and that kind of helped us. I think it just showed, you know, the community showed scientists that this is a viable vaccine modality. I think for any vaccine, you know, we have killed vaccines, weakened vaccines, RNA vaccines, recombinant virus vaccine. So I think, you know, having another way to make a vaccine is always beneficial because there's not one type of vaccine that's going to work for every virus. It depends on the virus, how it's transmitted, how the body responds to it. So having another way to make a vaccine, and in some cases, there's a lot of benefits. The mRNA vaccines can be made quicker than the egg-based vaccines for flu. So potentially, maybe if we do get that change in the virus that we saw after we started manufacturing, we could transition and make a...
You mean with the flu virus?
With the flu virus, right. We can make a vaccine more readily to adapt to that strain.
Our guest today is Eric Yeager. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll check the email bag in a moment. John is in Falls Village, Connecticut. Hello there, John.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call. I thought I heard a moment ago that a virus could have come from an asteroid or something from outer space or something like that. Did I hear that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Thanks, John. Yeah, it was Ray and I were kind of talking about potential theories about where viruses may have originated from.
Oh, okay.
And that's one theory. I think right now, I don't think there's a large concern that, you know, viruses are raining down and causing problems right now.
Hey, who knows, man? I mean, who really?
Maybe that's why the rocket ships are
launched. I mean, I can't imagine.
Yeah.
Don't viruses come from living things, living organisms, humans, whatever, a living thing?
They'll need a host cell to, you know, it could be a plant cell, insect cell, human cell. So they, you know, they don't have the ability to live on their own. Certainly there are certain conditions we can freeze a virus and keep it in storage, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, by and large, it's not something that they can just survive on their own for a long period of time.
So, John, have plenty to worry about, but I think we can relax on this one temporarily. Hey, man, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. Virology Today with Eric Yeager from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Let's say you're in a landslide.
Yeah.
And there was an old graveyard of people who died from a terrible virus a couple hundred years ago. And the remains of these people were suddenly out in the air. Are those viruses, could they be still viable? Or if a mastodon or one of those woolly mammoths defrosts out in the tundra, could there be something very bad?
If the cold conditions were kept such that the viral genetic material was intact, I think where we've seen, going back to the flu virus, much of what we knew about the 1918 flu that caused that pandemic back then, is scientists did actually exhume bodies that succumbed to that virus, and it could isolate. The viruses weren't viable, but it could isolate genetic material from those viruses, and then they did some experiments to understand why was that virus so pathogenic? Why did it cause such disease? So the blueprint of these viruses might persist, but I think it's less likely the virus would be viable. Bacteria, on the other hand, they've evolved to be quite fastidious. So there are some bacteria that do like cold conditions. So, if I was to put like a bet on which pathogen, again, not to cause concern, but if you're comparing a virus to bacteria in like permafrost or something, bacteria are a bit more hardier than viruses.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Eric Yeager's our guest. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Diane is in Saugerties. Hello, Diane in Saugerties.
Hello.
You're on.
I spent the last 2 days cleaning out a shed that was very filled with, I think, mouse and rat and other droppings. And this morning my throat is a tiny bit sore. I'm thinking hantavirus. Is it possible that I contracted that from that cleaning job?
Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Diane, for that question. So for the audience, hantavirus is a virus that is, as Anne mentioned, it's carried in mice. It was something that was in the news, I think it was maybe 20 plus years ago. It was in the four corners of the U.S., so I think New Mexico, Arizona, I'm forgetting the other states. Terrible of my lack of geography here, but there were a number of cases of hantavirus infection that were linked to mouse droppings.
Okay.
And the concern there was that this virus in the people that were infected had a high fatality rate. So there was some concern about hantavirus. I think in general, it's not a virus that is present at large places throughout the country. So I think, the odds of being hantavirus are, in my estimation, not being a doctor, but knowing where the viruses tend to go is low. It's, probably more to the dust kicked up and kind of irritating your airways because of the dust and particulate matter. But certainly, I think it's always prudent if you start to feel any symptoms of like flu-like illness is to, work with your clinician on that.
Okay. So, Diane, there's viable reason to be worried, I guess.
No reason to be worried.
No.
Right?
You'll be fine.
Yeah, I think you'll be fine.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. That's our telephone number. Remember, if possible, and you can do it, avoid the speakerphone. It sounds cleaner. I know sometimes if you're driving and you got to get in, I dig it. Try to minimize the noise as best you can. That way Mike Bowen, our engineer, won't throw something through the glass at me. And it could be very painful. Clark is in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Clark, you're on.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I listen to you and Gene Gagnon all the time. Oh. I have long COVID, and I started taking bromelain, a supplement. It's a pineapple enzyme. And it helps with the long COVID, but it 6 or 7 days after starting it, like my allergies mostly went away.
Hmm. Huh. Bromelain? I've not heard of this.
Yeah,
it's a pineapple enzyme. It's bromelain. I'm taking 1,700 milligrams about three times a day, caps.
Go figure.
But it's pretty fantastic.
Huh. Well, what do you think, Eric?
Yeah, thanks, Clark. I'm glad to hear you're feeling some alleviation of those symptoms. So even though the pandemic is something that we want to put in the rearview mirror, unfortunately, like long COVID is still, something that we're concerned about. And it was like Clark, who was, infected of COVID and then still feels symptoms months after that, or in some cases, years after that. So there is a lot of research trying to, hopefully it's not, too much of a negative impact on your ability to, your quality of life. Because then some people can really knock you down where, school, work, and just quality of life suffers. So there are a fair number of people out there that are suffering from these symptoms. And so the research, I've read some papers recently trying to understand, one, can we predict who might develop long COVID? Two, can we potentially diagnose it earlier? Because if we can treat earlier, hopefully that reduces the severity. And then three, like in Clark's situation, right, for those people that have it currently, are there therapies we can develop or give to alleviate the symptoms?
Yeah.
And like in Clark's case, there's a lot of anecdotal data. So people have tried different things. And I think if it gives you relief, great. Again, I'm not a doctor. I can't prescribe, I can't tell you how much bromelain to take or not take. But if it's giving you, relief and there's no risk to your health, certainly do it. A lot of the research I've seen more recently is looking at the antiviral drug Paxlovid, which you might recall that's a drug that
It's all
against
over the
COVID,
news.
You can give early, and it does, you know, much like other drugs for like flu. If you give it early enough, it can alleviate the severity, so you're not hospitalized. And
right.
So a lot of studies are looking now, like, what if you give Paxlovid earlier? Does it prevent long COVID? What if you give it to people suffering from long COVID? Can that relieve it? Similar to chronic Lyme, people in the audience might be aware, like some individuals that have chronic Lyme disease, again, very debilitating, they've reported relief after being given a long-term course of antibiotics. There's still a lot of controversy in the field. Is this something that should be more widely available? But people clearly have benefited from that.
Clark, thank you very much. Wait, antibiotics for a viral thing?
No, just sorry for the confusion. It was just a similar idea where someone suffering from long, from chronic Lyme, a bacterial disease.
Ah,
some
understood.
People have seen relief with long-term use of antibiotics. And with COVID, some individuals have reported relief of their symptoms taking long-term course of Paxlovid. So the typical course is 5 days. These individuals are taking 15 to 30 days.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Eric Yeager is our guest. We'll take a break here in a moment. So, at the beginning of this, the pandemic, that is, there was some question among scientists and researchers whether long COVID was a thing. Now, from the way you speak, I take it there is a consensus that it is a thing.
Yeah, again, it took some time, and I feel for the individuals that, you know, were feeling like not heard, like trying to go to their doctor, and there were people like, I'm really feeling these symptoms. It took some time for clinicians to line up, okay, what's the diagnosis? What are the symptoms that will line up with long COVID? So I think, from my understanding, once there's a clear diagnostic definition of what long COVID is, even though it varies from person to person, to at least establish medically in someone's record that, okay, they're suffering from long COVID. And then from that, again, opening up different routes of treatment.
Now, during the pandemic, and I may have the term wrong, but there was this bit about viral count or how much you have load, I guess.
Yeah,
it was,
viral
right?
load, yeah.
Have they checked these people who have or think they have long COVID? Have they checked, is the virus still present?
From my understanding, looking at the papers I've seen, it's no longer detectable, but there's the theories behind long COVID is one of those could be that too. Is there a reservoir of virus somewhere in the body we just can't detect? It's still causing problems. Is it activating other viruses? So many of us carry latent viruses like Epstein-Barr, cytomegalovirus. So there's some data to support that COVID infection reactivated these viruses.
Interesting.
They're causing the problems. In some people, it's triggered the production of autoantibodies and autoimmunity. In other people, it's impacted their mitochondrial function. So there's a lot with the virus. I think, and that's your question earlier about what do we know now about viruses. I think we appreciate now that viral infections can have dramatic impacts on the whole body. So even though you think, flu or COVID, it's just my respiratory system I have to worry about. But these viruses can cause systemic effects.
Can you have long flu or long common cold?
Surprisingly, there's some studies that suggest there is, long-term sequelae or complications after flu infection. I think COVID, just because the sheer number of individuals that were infected and then, still could report these symptoms months after, we have a grasp of those individuals.
Eric Yeager joins us from Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences today. The number is 800-348-2551. Email voxpop@wamc.org. We'll check the email bag coming up. There's Block Party from Nelson, Esposito, and Quintana on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. Our guest today is Eric Yeager from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. He's on. He's been on for about 42 minutes, and I'm not petrified yet. So this is we're making progress. Cheryl writes, having gone through Lyme treatment, I learned that bacteria have a biofilm making them difficult to treat. Do viruses have the same outer structure making them difficult to treat or for the body to take care of? If so, how would one treat? During Lyme, I took medication in conjunction with antibiotics, but how would one expedite treatment for a virus? We
great
talked
question.
About the M&M analogy, right?
Most of the antiviral drugs we have, they target the pathways the virus is using. So that's the challenge. Certainly with bacteria, they can form these communities called biofilms that can make them more resistant to antibiotics. For the virus, the key is they're inside the cell, right? The biofilm is forming on outside of cells typically. So the concern is getting the drug inside the cell, not harming the healthy cell's normal pathways. And then in some cases, we have viruses that go latent, so they can integrate in some cases into our DNA. So I think the trouble or the hurdle with some of these antivirals is, one, we don't want to harm the cells and cause these side effects, right? We want to treat just the virus and virally infected cells. And then second, for those viruses that go latent, and in some cases like HIV, for example, integrates into our genome, how do we treat those? How do we get them out of our genome? So that's a lot of work being done to, and some of my colleagues at the college, understanding how to treat HIV.
I like the way that our writer described the bacteria. When you've described the virus, and specifically the COVID in the early days, you described the hard outer shell. And some viruses are easier than others, right?
Easier to eliminate or...
To break that shell, to get in there.
Yeah, I think the protein shell itself, so viruses like the norovirus, for example, just has that outer protein shell. Now, that does give it more stability in the environment. That's why norovirus is a bit more challenging to get rid of. Those viruses that have an envelope, so they've taken lipids from our cells as they've left us. They've taken part of that envelope material. Those are more easy to disrupt. So you can use different disinfectants to disrupt that lipid envelope. They're more susceptible to changes in the environment and to some disinfectants. The what they're called naked viruses, the ones that have that protein capsid, those are more hardier.
All right. Jeff in Western Mass writes in, our 7-year-old granddaughter has been diagnosed with RSV. Will this continue on as she gets older, or any prevention she could follow?
Yeah, thanks for that. RSV is one of those other viruses, kind of the triple viruses we worry about with the flu and cold season. So flu, COVID-19, and RSV. And RSV is a virus that impacts young children and older adults. And most children contract the virus by the age, I believe, of two. We're at a much better place where we are now with RSV than we were maybe 5-10 years ago, because now we have effective vaccines against RSV. So if you're in that older age group, 65 or older, or if you have some pre-existing health conditions, you know, 50 and up, vaccines work very well to prevent severe outcomes. For children, there's a vaccine that pregnant females can get to protect the child. And there is a monoclonal therapy that we can deliver to the child shortly after birth to protect them.
What does monoclonal mean?
So a monoclonal is an antibody that has a single specificity. So these are engineered antibodies that are basically they target the part of that RSV virus to bind to it to prevent that virus. I used that lock and key analogy in the past. So it prevents that virus from using its key to get inside the host cell. With the question I was asked, RSV is an acute infection. So once someone has it, they develop some immunity, they clear it. Individuals can get infected again with RSV later in life, but the areas of concern are really like very young in age, very old in age, where you can start to get some severe outcomes where it can infect your breathing. You might need to be hospitalized. But again, we're in a much better situation where we were a few years back. We have really good vaccines to protect people against those severe outcomes, both older adults, pregnant individuals, and young children.
John writes in, could you comment on sewage testing for virus residue and how it might help us in the future? That was something that hit the newspapers.
Yeah, that's and maybe one of the other things that came out of our pandemic, too, is different ways to do surveillance to understand what viruses are going to be at risk.
Yeah.
And wastewater has become a really powerful tool, wastewater testing. So what it really boils down to is we can detect a lot of viruses that are passed through wastewater. I'll leave it to your imagination to understand how. But we can isolate that wastewater material, isolate viruses there, do genetic testing like PCR, RT-PCR, and get a handle on what viruses are people infected with now, and we can get that information before they start going to the hospital.
Okay.
So that gives public health officials, hospitals, other individuals a heads up about, okay, what are the viruses that we have to worry about? And the CDC website, you can check, and it does show, based on where wastewater testing is being performed, they can look for the trends for, is RSV low, is flu low, is COVID low? So it's been a very powerful tool, because the better information we have going in, that's one of the other answers to the questions, is preparation, right? If we know what viruses are on the horizon as best we can prepare for it. Again, utilizing vaccines, antivirals if we have them, but in some cases just changing behavior.
But that job, I mean, you give that to the interns, right? You got to collect some sewage.
The first-year students.
All right, here we go, and we'll go back to the phones in a minute. One more email here. This is... I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. I think it's Sheila, but it's an Irish spelling. I have no idea how to say it, but we'll just call her Sheila. Every year I make sure to get the flu vaccine. I usually get it in early November. I know the flu virus can mutate, and we talked about this. Yeah. So will the flu shot you receive early in the flu season protect you against the mutations?
Normally in a year, the normal time to get the flu vaccine after it's been, as a process I discussed earlier, once identified, these are the strains we think are going to circulate, be a problem in the Northern Hemisphere, you know, getting that vaccine October to November is key, right? That's right before the season starts.
Yeah.
Again, even if it doesn't match well to the strains that are circulating, it still is going to prevent those. It's still going to give you protection against those severe outcomes. So hospitalization, exacerbation of, you know, heart disease, lung disease. If you have asthma, it can prevent that from being exacerbated. So it's still worth getting. You know, no vaccine is 100% to protect you against getting sick by that virus. But what we're really doing is making sure that people are protected against those severe outcomes. And it may reduce some of the transmission as well.
And I know you're not an epidemiologist, yeah, but what have we learned about herd immunity?
Oh, great. Oh, you're learning. Yeah. I don't know if
are
it's because of me.
Listen, we have all learned so many terms that when we talk to someone who knows what they mean, yeah, you must think, wow, you know a term, but you're really an idiot still.
No. I know. It actually warms my heart when
okay,
people
fine.
Speak the
all
language
right.
I speak.
Okay.
So again, not a full epidemiologist, Mike, my colleague, Dr. Dollett at ACPHS, but herd immunity is a term used to explain what level of protection do we need to prevent the spread of a disease. And the protection can come from natural infection, because again, we have our immune system. Our immune system does a good job at protecting us, or even vaccinated, so you have existing immunity. And for certain viruses, we know because they're contagious, we need to have a certain level of herd immunity. So for example, measles, again, it's in the news a lot.
Yeah.
Herd immunity, we need to have a certain level, like, greater than 95% overall to prevent the spread of the virus.
Yeah.
So it gives, again, scientists, health care workers, governments, an understanding of what levels we need to achieve to prevent the spread. And what the herd immunity is doing is it's preventing the virus from spreading easily to those people that are susceptible.
Uh-huh.
They've not been vaccinated. They can't get vaccinated. That's what people are trying to protect.
Let's go to Joel in West Hampton. Joel, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi. Quick question. I had COVID back in September. My wife just had a COVID shot because she's going away. I was wondering, how long does my immunity likely to last, and should I get another shot because the virus is probably mutated into something else, a different strain?
Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Joel, for that question. What we've learned, too, about COVID is certainly, yes, it mutates. And maybe if we did, kind of a flashback to one of the first shows, I probably said, oh, COVID's not going to mutate. We're fine. But now scientists understand that COVID does mutate. These
yeah.
variants come up quite readily. So the mutation is a problem. But also, we've learned, too, that the immunity against this virus, for reasons that aren't fully understood, wanes after a 4 to 6 month period. So whether you've been infected naturally or you've been vaccinated, what we know is that the immunity lasts, again, 4 to 6 months. So in individuals that are in a high-risk group based on age, underlying health conditions, a lot of the recommendations put out by the CDC and a lot of the professional medical associations do recommend staying up to date for COVID vaccine. And in some cases, you may want to get a second dose of the vaccine to make sure your antibody levels stay high enough to protect you. So again,
okay, so I'm at the end of the line on this.
Could be, yeah, could be.
That's not a good way to put it, Joel, but thank you for the call, sir. 800-348-2551. George is in Northern Westchester. George, where are you in Northern Westchester?
Croton Falls.
Oh, God's country. Well, welcome. You're on the air. Go ahead.
I have a question. I'm actually fairly new to the area and new to having a big dog. I have a 100-pound golden. And we would go out walking just by the edge of the street, and there'd be ticks hopping on him even in the wintertime.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, he gets treated, so he's okay in terms of his health for exposure to Lyme and other diseases. But what about for the human side? Is there any chance of them rolling out any type of human vaccine or some immunization for us for Lyme? And someone told me that they've begun to do something in Sweden or Scandinavia, and I'm curious.
Yeah, thanks, George. Yeah, certainly, in, our area in the country, ticks are a concern, wooded areas. And they do carry bacteria like the one that causes Lyme disease. There's some viruses they carry as well. The veterinary vaccine against Lyme, I think, has been available for quite a long time and is still used, very effective. There was a human vaccine available for, I'm trying to remember the dates. My father-in-law works on a road crew. He got the vaccine because he's out in the woods a lot and ticks are there. The vaccine that was available in the past, I think, for some reasons, maybe it was demand or other issues, it was taken kind of off the market. I think there was a story a colleague of mine told me in the Times Union, maybe on Sunday or Saturday, there's work being done to creating a new Lyme vaccine that, targets the proteins expressed on the bacteria. And vaccines work, in some cases, very similar for a virus or bacteria. We want to generate those antibodies that bind to the microbe and prevent it from causing infection. So it does seem like, I'm not as up to date in Lyme. But I do think there's a lot of work being done to generate a effective human vaccine, and hopefully we'll see that put out within the next 5 years or so. Because it is, you know, with the change in the climate, the warming that we see during the winter, that allows greater population of ticks. Again, yeah. Ticks are carrying these
bacteria. They're bad this year.
Yeah, so that's the concern. I wouldn't be surprised there's research being done on some of the viral infections carried by ticks, because we do want to make sure people are protected against those pathogens.
So true. George, thanks for the call. Let's go to Greenwich, Connecticut. And Melissa, you're on.
Oh, hi. How are you? It's another long COVID call.
Okay, go ahead.
So my 18-year-old nephew is incredibly sick with long COVID. He was an athlete. He's got every symptom in the book, and he's got a Lyme co-infection, as it turns out, other co-infections, and his antibodies are attacking his immune system. There's not much treatment in the U.S., it seems, for these problems, and certainly insurance doesn't cover. He has microclotting in his blood, and they put stents in him. Well, long story short, he's now in southern Germany, where there's a clinic. And he's undergoing some pretty intense procedures that do not seem to be available in the U.S., apheresis for the long COVID and hyperthermia for Lyme and other co-infections. So that's a bit of sharing. And I guess my question would be, do we see that the U.S. is going to play catch-up anytime soon? And I should say that he's only in through the first week of his treatment. I'm actually going there on back over there on Friday to help. It's going to be about a six-week process, but I'm wondering where you see the U.S. treatment going with all of
good
this long
question.
COVID, because it's very serious.
Excellent question.
Yeah, thank you for sharing, Melissa, and I wish your nephew well. Hopefully those treatments, you know, give him relief. I think certainly there is a gap. There is more research needed to understand best ways to treat. And I think, you know, Melissa's story really highlights that it is kind of like an individual disease. Like, it can vary from person to person, and the amount of body systems involved, the idea of, you know, clots, antibodies, things like that can vary from person to person. That's what makes it challenging. And maybe explain some of the hesitation is that there's unfortunately not one therapy fits all. There are a couple centers in the U.S. I think there's one in Yale. There's one, there are a couple of long COVID centers I'm aware of at academic medical centers in the U.S., and they are doing clinical trials to understand what therapies will work. But as I mentioned, there's a large proportion of people in the U.S. that do suffer from long COVID. So I do hope that more money is put towards that, because we really do need, I mean, these are, you know, to Melissa's case here, her nephew was an athlete. And now I'm sure like he's unable to do that. Like really sad stories of people like their life changing overnight. So I do hope that, you know, more research is put into understanding how to treat these, and you know, treat these symptoms. And unfortunately, too, what we do know is that the one way to prevent it is not to get COVID. I know it doesn't help Melissa's nephew, but for those of you worried about long COVID, staying up to date, vaccination, we do know, reduces the risk of long COVID.
Melissa, we got to leave it there. Thank you very much. We're almost out of time. Nancy writes in, I was diagnosed with RSV by PCR earlier this month, and I was vaccinated against RSV 2 years ago. I'm currently being treated for bacterial pneumonia. I'm 80. And in excellent health. How effective is the vaccine, and should I consider being vaccinated again? That's from Nancy. We have about 30 seconds here.
Yeah, the RSV vaccine for older adults is very effective at preventing severe outcomes. What she's probably talking about is a secondary bacterial infection. So the vaccine, again, is against the virus.
Right,
the
not the bacterial pneumonia.
Current recommendations are just a single shot, so there's no booster recommendation for RSV yet. I suspect we'll probably, as we learn more about how durable that immune response is, are boosters needed, but for currently just a single shot. But for those individuals of a certain age group with underlying health conditions, the effectiveness is quite good for preventing those severe outcomes. So if you're in the 65 and older, if you have underlying conditions, the vaccine is recommended.
All right, final question. How do you sleep at night? How do you do it?
I sleep pretty soundly.
Do you really?
Oh, okay. Maybe.
I got to talk to your doctor. Hey, man, thanks for being here. Eric Yeager, always great.
Thanks, Ray.
Support comes from Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, empowering local nonprofits and donors to transform lives throughout the region. CommunityFoundationsHV.org. Capital Region Classical at Union College, presenting Eben String Quartet from Paris in works of Mozart, Debussy, and Brahms, Sunday, April 12th, 3 p.m., capitalregionclassical.org, and Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, presenting their Spring Fair at 62 York Avenue, Saturday, May 2nd, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., celebrating the season with natural crafts, activities, homemade foods, WaldorfSaratoga.org. Once again, thanks to Dr. Eric Yeager for being here today. He'll be back. Don't worry if you didn't get through. And if the world ends again, he'll be on like every week. So you'll get your chance. Thanks again to our engineer, Mike Bowen. Well done. Phone screened by Andrea Leong. I'm Ray Graff. All right, tomorrow, well, it's the Science Forum. And we'll talk a bit about this Artemis II launch, which is happening in about 3 hours. It'll be fun. We'll see you, too.